Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College online journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hello and welcome to the War Room podcast. I'm Andrew Hill, the Chair of Strategic Leadership at the U.S. Army War College and the War Room Senior Editor. Today's podcast, we are joined by Major Matthew Cavanaugh, who is a U.S. Army strategist. Major Cavanaugh, welcome to the War Room podcast.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So he is here as a speaker as part of the United States Army War College's strategy conference, which is looking at future challenges for strategic leaders. Major Cavanaugh has recently edited and contributed to a volume which has a fantastic title, Strategy Strikes Back, How Star Wars Explains Modern Military Conflict. So to start out, how did this book come about?
That's a good question. So in a couple ways, it started with teaching at West Point and trying to relate strategic concepts to cadets. And then following that assignment, moving to Korea and then serving on a staff with Korean military officers. And what you find really quickly is that if you're trying to teach or talk strategy with other people that don't have a common understanding of what happened in the past, say that they don't have the same baseline knowledge of the American Civil War, what happened at Gettysburg, the Second World War, whatever the conflict might be. If you don't have familiar terrain, then it's incredibly difficult to talk or teach strategy. And whether you're talking with a cadet or a Korean, the one war that we all know something about is Star Wars. It crosses generational boundaries, linguistic boundaries, cultural boundaries. Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, it's the modern version of Thucydides' Peloponnesian War.
Or maybe the Trojan War.
Yeah, I mean... It's a myth. It is. But it's... there are, because storylines can't drift too far out, the storylines have to have some plausible relation to the real world. In fact, Rian Johnson, the writer-director of the most recent Star Wars film that was released this last December, said that he drew most of his inspiration from the history of Rome and the conflicts and the feuding that fueled and ultimately broke apart that society. And so I think that Star Wars, while imperfect, is just another way for us to look at modern war and to better understand strategy as a craft.
So one of the awesome things about writing that I always try to explain to students is when you write, you are in a conversation with yourself more than anything. Yeah. You know, writing a good article or chapter is a learning process for the writer. So what did you learn from what you did in contributing to this book and editing it as well?
Yeah, it clarified for me a couple of things. I find the same thing whenever I write anything. I don't really understand my own opinion until I've written it down, because it forces you to put on your thinking cap and to clarify the ideas and how you're going to march those ideas out into the world. One thing that I picked up from editing the book was that there are so many different thoughts and ideas about the same conflict. You know, when I started thinking about what topic I would take on, I went straight to one particular subject, and that's actually evaluating Yoda as a strategist. because that draws out what it forced me to think about what I expect of myself as an Army strategist. But what was great about the book is that I was able to collaborate with 30 other writers from all walks of life, all walks of strategy. So General Stan McChrystal wrote the foreword. Admiral James Stavridis wrote one of our chapters. Max Brooks, who wrote World War Z, wrote one of the chapters. August Cole, co-wrote Ghost Fleet, wrote one of the chapters. So there's some big names there, but then there are also some officers serving in tactical units, Marines, naval officers, diplomats. And what you find really quickly is how many different perspectives there are on the same conflict and how many different valuable perspectives there are on the same conflict. And for me, it highlighted how important it is to create a venue or a forum for diverse ideas to come together and hopefully bring out the best outcome, or at least come to some product that's greater than the individual parts. And I think the book is that.
Well, and hopefully you'll also not just end up with a lot of national security professionals who have a better understanding of strategy, but many Star Wars fans.
Yeah.
Ideally.
Yeah,
who are far more numerous than the national security professionals.
I know. We're finding that right now. Yeah. Actually, one of the contributors to the book spent an entire day recently on Facebook searching out Star Wars fan groups and messaging them on Facebook, and he was actually kicked off of Facebook for a day because they thought he was a bot.
Very active.
It was a very busy day, and it took him all day to find a good number of Star Wars fan groups. There's a lot of them out there. So serve.
One of the hard things about military leadership is that most of the time we're evaluating military leaders in what we sort of imagine to be the competitive environment, but not the actual one.
Yep.
So you talked about how you looked at George Washington, mm-hmm. Ulysses S. Grant, and Dwight Eisenhower. And I was thinking, okay, so how would I have assessed these guys without knowing anything about their actual performance in war?
Yeah.
Grant seems like a particularly tough case, mm-hmm. because his performance not in war was sort of unremarkable,
sure.
right? Yet we're trying to build an officer corps and a leadership of the military that ideally we can sort of know something about their judgment, their strategic capabilities, without finding out the hard way that it sucks, like the hard way, right?
Mm-hmm. So let me just backpedal a little bit and explain some of the background to the dissertation. So what I was really looking to draw out was what characteristics differentiate successful leadership from unsuccessful leadership, and successful supreme command from unsuccessful supreme command. And so this is where I found the difference. And it wasn't material factors, weapons, or stuff. It wasn't luck, and their adversaries were competent. The difference was superior judgment and decision-making. So I looked at the performance of three supreme commanders that had steered wars to successful conclusion during periods where the conflict could have gone either way. So Washington in the summer of 76 into 1777, Grant in 1864 through the election that November, because if the Confederates had succeeded in throwing the election to McClellan, the war might have turned out very differently. And Eisenhower in 1944 until the Allies took Paris, because I sort of figured that by the time the Allies are at Paris, and especially the German border, the war is, the Germans are fighting a two-front war on home borders, so the war is effectively over. So I tried to go left of fait accompli, right? Like before the war is on a course to certain mm-hmm. conclusion. And so what I found was compared to their opponents, Washington, Grant, and Eisenhower, their judgments, when you evaluate them, were objectively better than their adversaries. So different strategies, different time periods, different war aims, all these changed. But when you dig into the dispatches and memorandums and the decisions of the supreme commanders on both sides, I found superior judgment remained the determining or the most important factor. There were other factors that certainly mattered, but most important factor. So in thinking through this, supreme commanders to me, or senior generals, act as decision funnels for their side. So ideas, opinions, mm-hmm. options, courses of action go in the top, and only one strategic choice comes out the narrower bottom end. And they make these decisions under extreme duress. So one example that I would point to is that when you look to books like Richard Overy's Why the Allies Won, his argument, one of his arguments was air power. And he essentially says the Allies had the advantage of air power. And by extension, they could land airborne drops wherever they wanted. But the problem with making that sort of bumper sticker assessment is that it doesn't dig into the question that underpins that. How do you use airborne forces? So before the D-Day landings, Eisenhower faced a very important choice, where to make the airborne drops. Omar Bradley wanted the drops to happen right behind the beach. So the Germans on the beach would have a dilemma. They'd have to face invaders from the water and then airborne troops from their rear. General Marshall actually carved off some of his own personal staff to come up with an assessment that argued that we should send airborne troopers two-thirds of the way to Paris. So he wanted to see a deep envelopment. He wanted to really pull the Germans, particularly in their mobile reinforcement. And then 1 week before the landings, Trafford Leigh Mallory, the air component commander, the British air component commander that worked for General Eisenhower, came to him and said, if you make these airborne drops where General Bradley wants them, 75 to 80% of them will be killed in action. They'll be combat ineffective. So Eisenhower had three options. You know, drop the airborne troops, the two American divisions and the British, near the beach, send them two-thirds of the way to Paris, or don't make the drops at all because his air component commander is telling him they will be combat ineffective. And when you dig into the back and forth that exists in the historical record, you find this truly tortured decision that Eisenhower makes. And I lifted this line from his own writing on that particular moment. Quote, it would be difficult to conceive of a more soul-racking problem. Because if he doesn't make the drops at all, then he's
Potentially jeopardizing the amphibious landings.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And this process that I just described repeated itself over and over and over, not just for Washington, Grant, and Eisenhower, but for their opponents too. And when you lay those out, you see that there's a pattern that emerges, that the successful supreme commanders exercise relatively better judgment and decisions. Now, there are other theories out there about how we should evaluate supreme commanders and senior generals.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, for example, they don't matter. It's the system. It's almost like a kind of Marxist view of, you know, war. It's
absolutely.
It was American industrial might,
yes,
and Soviet manpower, and this was going to end one way. It just was a question of when, not whether.
Absolutely. This is IR theory. This is John Mearsheimer, his offensive realism, the idea that more stuff wins wars.
Yeah.
God is on the side of the biggest battalions in Napoleon's parlance. But that's not entirely true. When you look at these cases, for example, General Washington was at a ridiculous material disadvantage. Grant had a material advantage, but Lee had beaten an army that was similarly sized 1 year before on the exact same terrain. And when Eisenhower is dropping into Normandy, he's only on that first day, he's only getting a few divisions ashore, while the Nazi Western Wall, the Atlantic Wall, was roughly 60 divisions. So you know, all three had variable material imbalances, and I think that's an argument that instead of what the Melian dialogue tells us, which is that might makes right, in a lot of ways when it comes to supreme command, right makes might, who has the superior decisions wins.
Yeah. I mean, my favorite historical example is Genghis Khan,
who takes down
the Chinese, and the Mongols are a pastoral, step-based. I mean, this would be like, the Navajo with 19th century technology taking out America in the mid 20th century.
The Dothraki.
Let me ask you, let me give you your point, which is that, hey, leadership, supreme command, to use your term, matters, and that it has really significant consequences when it's done well or badly. All right, so let's accept that premise. What is the NFL combine equivalent of assessing whether that exists without knowing, the conditions in which it's going to be tested?
Absolutely. First of all, we cannot know the conditions of future conflict.
Right.
And so
this is a big problem.
It is. So one thing one of the simpler aspects that I would counsel or that I picked up on is that our successful supreme commanders really truly read very widely. They had many experiences in many different walks of life. Washington's library. So what's really cool about George Washington's library is that in the 19-teens, a scholar went in and inventoried everything. And so there's literally a book out there that is a compendium of all the things that existed in Washington's personal library. And there was an amazing diversity of interests in there: gardening, botany, architecture, other languages, other cultures, geography. But he also had some very specific interests. So he was reading books about his British opponents. He literally was buying the roles of the British Army to better understand his opponents. With Grant, Grant had a particular interest in literature. He actually was a part of what we would call a book club now at West Point. And Eisenhower was the same way, particularly after his assignment in 1922 in Panama with General Fox Connor. So there's a wide range of scholarly interests that you can see in the curiosities and the personal preparation from these particular successful supreme commanders. But let's pull that forward. So what does the NFL combine look like? I actually think that it looks a lot like Philip Tetlock's Good Judgment Project, which is at the University of Pennsylvania. It's affiliated with the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Agency. And what they do is they create judgment tournaments, and they're mostly geopolitical judgments. They ask for predictions on events that likely will occur in the near term, the short term, and then they ask for confidence levels. So how confident are you that the North Korean US/ Kim Jong-un, President Trump summit will happen in May? And what is your confidence level of that particular geopolitical event? So they don't ask enormous questions like, will there be a war with North Korea? They ask measurable, short-term questions like that. But what's important about those measurable, short-term questions is that when you add them up, when you put together a number of them, those little questions can provide much bigger answers. And I think of Supreme Command the same way. It's a constant process of evaluating the environment, making judgments, and in some cases making decisions. So if you wanted an NFL combine for generals and supreme commanders, I would love it if the government created some sort of a pilot program that, where general officers would occasionally subject themselves to some questions about potential geopolitical events related to war. And I think what you would find is two things. One, you would find the people that are naturally good at making geopolitical judgments, geostrategic judgments. But secondly, you would find, I think, that they would improve. That even if they weren't, they started on day one, they weren't very good at it, they were kind of at the bottom of the class, the ones at the bottom of the class would get better, and the ones at the top of the class would get better, and everyone in the middle would be the same. So I think there's a lot of value in an approach like that, because when you get down to the core of what the military profession is expected to provide to the nation, it's strategic judgment. And so I think that's something that we really ought to consider.
You talk about, in some sense, one of my favorite definitions of intelligence is intellectual curiosity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just this interest in learning new things. I was struck by the way you portrayed these generals as, in some sense, building different models of possible worlds in their exposure to literature, history, and so on. We have this expression that we often use, which I hate, which is history teaches us blank, right? And anyone who reads history extensively knows that history, if anything, history teaches us that a lot of different things can happen, mm-hmm. from the same, yep. conditions, that's very hard to know for certain how things are going to turn out. In an earlier conversation with another guest here at the strategy conference, Dr. Pauline Shanks-Corin, she talked about how the Stoics teach this approach to mentally rehearsing, mm-hmm. you know, conditions, bad conditions, things that are really going to challenge you. Think about the things that you fear and how you would handle those. And I'm struck by your comments. It's sort of analogous to that. It's like, mm-hmm. what you're basically suggesting is, one thing that prepares you for the inherent uncertainty of future conflict is to explore a wide variety of possibilities, mm-hmm. through your reading.
You know, I think the hardest lesson for strategic leaders, and specifically for the supreme commanders that I spent time reading about and thinking about, was the moment when they realized that they're alone. They're the ones making the decisions. That reality hits them like a ton of bricks. And it is very good that, in my best understanding, that I believe that they had put themselves in scenarios like that before they were in that moment. And I think that two things can give you that. One is writing, actually. Like, if you are creating words on a page, if you are crafting an argument, if you are creating something new on paper, then I think that actually can translate into the real world. If you can see something to fruition that's new on paper, I think you can create a new monopoly on violence in the real world. It's not a direct translation, but I think it helps. And then the second one is actually fiction. Consuming fiction of all things can help you crawl into the mind and the skin of another person. And that's incredibly useful, not just so that you can understand new scenarios, but so that you can crawl into the mind of your opponent. And that's incredibly valuable, to see something from the other side of the hill, from another person's perspective. And sometimes it's kind of lost, I think, in military, with military audiences. So we spend so much time with history and theory. Mm-hmm. So since the U.S. Civil War was over, there have been 70,000 books written about the conflict, more than one a day. You know, and someone's reading all those books, and it's a lot of people with short haircuts. When it comes to theory, the Song Dynasty alone in China, there were 43 separate 1,000-page commentaries on Sun Tzu's Art of War. We've mined history. We've mined theory. And I feel like fiction is kind of an unnoticed stepchild. It exists. It's there. We read a lot of Once an Eagle. You know, we read a lot of certain books, Gates of Fire. But I think we could do more with those lessons from fiction, particularly because it like I mentioned, puts you in another person's shoes.
Yeah. So I teach a course here called Great Books, and every year we change the books up, but every year we start with the Iliad. Earlier I said that, you know, I talked about the myth of the Trojan War. Obviously the Trojan War was a real conflict, but there's a lot of mythology surrounding the war, right?
Yeah.
And it's amazing how what is essentially a work of fiction, an epic poem, right? It's essentially a work of fiction, how it resonates with students almost 3,000 years after its composition.
Yeah.
You learn empathy, I think, from fiction in a way that you can't really learn from reading nonfiction. On that note, sort of last question, since we're talking about books, is there anything you've read recently that you really like that you would recommend to our audience?
Yeah, a couple things. Since I already mentioned it, I actually loved Philip Tetlock's Super Forecasters, which is a book that was written based on the results from that IARPA / Good Judgment Project. So I highly recommend that because...
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of his as well.
Yeah.
Expert Political Judgment is a great book.
Yeah, well. And I think a lot of those lessons really translate. It rings true with me here in the military just based on my own experience. I just had the airport pickup read in flight experience with the book New Power that's just out. It's got a yellow cover, bright yellow cover. You can't miss it. I don't remember the name of the two authors, but the book is essentially making a case that power is wielded differently today than it was obviously 50 years ago, but not just 50 years ago, 5 years ago. And while I was convinced and persuaded by some of the arguments, I also was skeptical of others that I felt would be pretty difficult to translate into a military environment. I doubt that I'm going to get ISIS to stand down with a really great Twitter campaign, you know? And then you mentioned Genghis Khan. So I never thought I could get this into a warlord. But Jack Weatherford's book, the Genghis Khan and the Modern World.
That's an awesome book.
So I take extra pride because he teaches at a school in St. Paul, Minnesota, where I'm from. So I was super keen about that. And, you know... obviously, I have to shill for Strategy Strikes Back, but honestly, I feel as though there is something in the book for everyone. That it's not everyone's cup of tea, but I think everyone could benefit from that, from the book, whether you're a cadet or a colonel or a Korean or a civilian. And then lastly, I'd honestly say this a lot, but I'd say the best book is one that you fill up with pen and ink with your own thoughts and reflections. I have a problem I see a new cool notebook and I buy them and I...
You have a moleskin fetish?
I do, man. And so I recommend that to anybody and everybody because... You never know when a good idea is going to strike you, and you got to get it on paper because it'll be gone just that quick.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate you giving your time, and thanks for keeping it interesting.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'd love to be back, and I look forward to the next time.
Thank you all for joining us here in the War Room. We hope that you join us again.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.